Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Armchair Survivalist. My name is Kurt Wilson. I'm the Armchair Survivalist, and it is February the 2nd in the year 2020. So, again, welcome to the show. Now, there's all kinds of different ways to listen to me. You can go to armchairsurvivalist.com and click on the chat room, and generally, you can listen in there. Now, there's something going on with the Flash player. Maybe they updated it or something, because I can't actually get the chat room to function where people can talk in there. Anyway, you can still listen there, and or you can go to any of these podcast places like Stitcher and Anchor and Podbean, iHeartRadio. I'm even on YouTube, Digital Podcast, and then there's a whole bunch of these little things. You go to armchairsurvivalist.com and scroll down, and you'll see all kinds of little podcast places. I don't even know, the cast box and all kinds of stuff. And then there's my RSS feed there. If you want that, you just click on that, and if you know how to use it, then that's fine. Or you can listen on Global Star 3 satellite. That's Galaxy 19 Transponder 5. There is a 24/7 live feed. There's two links there for Global Star 3 satellite. And down, let's see, that says you can listen in the chat room. Now you can also listen on your phone. You dial area code 641-741-0371. Now, that's not toll-free, but it's area code 641-741-0371. And if you missed the show, at the top of the page, there's this in the blue box, says listen 24 hours a day to the most recent show of the Armchair Survivalist. Click here. Do that, and you'll hear the most recent show. In fact, most of the time, let me tell you how this works. I cut my show on Saturday, and it's going to sound a little different today because I have to be in my bunker cutting my show on portable power because we have a windstorm here in Coeur d'Alene doing 60 miles an hour, knocking things down. Highway 90 is closed on both sides because of the trees falling. We have no power in my studio, so I'm running this on a 1995 headset I've had about 20 years. Anyway, then I upload that to my engineer, Todd, on Saturday night, and then he posts it and then plays it live on Sunday 2 to 4. But you can hear it Saturday night. It's just one of the tricks. I post it personally before then. Now, if you want to download the show, you go on the left-hand side of any of the pages at armchairsurvivalist.com, and you'll see the little nipper dog, little white dog, listening to the RCA Victor gramophone. You click on that. And it'll say the Armchair Survivalist past shows. And I have all of the shows there that I've done for the past year. Now I have 2019 there, and that's going to be deleted in the next few days. And if you want to download all my shows, that's one of the places you can go to do so. Or you can play them directly there. Now, one of the places, in fact, the main place that hosts me is anchor.fm. It has all my shows there. You just go to anchor.f as in Frank, M as in Mary. And it'll show all my shows. Look, I got to get right into this because I don't have long to talk. And I don't know when the power is going to go. So I want to, right now, I need to scare the hell out of you. And I'm not being lightweight about this. I'm very, very serious. In the past week, I've done some rather intensive research on this, what's called the Wuhan novel coronavirus. And I put together a briefing sheet. And everybody I've given it to has read it and said, well, I knew this and I knew that, but I sure as hell didn't know blankety blank blank. I'm going to read it to you, and I'm going to extrapolate some of the statements in it. And this is vital that you listen to this, if nothing else. In 2018, People Liberation Army of China, through the Institute of Military Medicine and the Nanking Command, registered new virus, bat-like SARS virus, in the United States National Center for Biotechnology. In the U.S., the National Center for Biotechnology is where everyone registers a virus that they come up with. It's almost like a patent house for viruses. And that way, other scientists, let's say a virus pops up and it starts killing a bunch of people, and scientists all over the world want to help figure out a vaccine or something, well, that's where they go to get samples. The genome sequence, in other words, the virus, was given a registration number of AVP78033.1. All right, so all of these are given registration numbers. When the Wuhan novel coronavirus, aka 2019-nCoV, was genetically sequenced using the BLAST technique, basic local alignment search tools, it was given a registration number of QHD43418.1. Okay, so that this new virus that came out of China was registered. When the AVP78033.1 was compared with QHD43418.1, it was discovered that they both had identical envelope protein. Now, if you can imagine a water balloon, inside is water, right? And what's holding it in is the envelope protein. In other words, that which encases both of these viruses were identical. The internal virus of QHD had been modified by the addition of a coronavirus being mixed with the original bat-like SARS virus. So, in other words, a virus that was registered by the Chinese government has markers exactly the same as the virus as the Wuhan novel coronavirus. No mutation has occurred. It's not like the AVP78033.1 mutated, because if it mutated, the envelope would have mutated also. Both of these viruses have the same exact, not close, exact envelope protein with no mutations. This virus, this created virus, has the highest rate of contagion of any known virus. The Wuhan virus is spread by bodily fluids of the infected person. Any bodily fluids, blood, semen, sweat, tears, saliva, anything. The Wuhan virus can survive on any surface outside of a host body for 5 to 28 days. Now, each one of these particles of data that I'm giving you could save your life, so listen closely. Governments lie. It's that simple. The Chinese government has been lying since day one. They've been lying since before day one. Our government is lying because they don't want a massive freakout such as we had in the stock market Friday. When it dropped over 600 points. So they're not going to give you all of this data. Now they're holding almost 200 people, that Americans that flew back from China. They were quarantining them, and now it's like a definite hard block quarantine for 14 days at an Air Force base. 14 days is not enough time, because as far as they tell, this virus has lived up to 28 days outside of a host body. The Lancet Journal of Medicine and the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, have come out with the following data. Of 100 people infected, 83% will become symptomatic. Incubation of the Wuhan novel coronavirus is between 4 and 14 days. Now again, everything I'm telling you is vital that you get. I'm going to have this posted so that people can read it. Now, at armchairsurvivalist.com, on the left-hand side of the page, you'll see show notes. You click on that, and it'll take you to the date of a show. It'll show all the dates of all my shows. You click on the date you want, and you're going to want February 2nd. And I'll have this posted there with it. So incubation is 4 to 14 days. It's not 98% of infected will spike a fever. You get that? 98%, which means 1 out of 50 show no fever. So that's 2% do not spike a fever. They can be infected. They have no fever. So all of these tests that they're doing with the laser temperature probe they're shooting people on the forehead with it as they come and go at the airports is only good 98% of the time. 76% of infected will start coughing. The infected are contagious from initial infection, whether symptomatic or not. They're infectious from the instant they receive the virus. The Wuhan novel coronavirus, if not treated immediately, attacks the lungs and kidneys, creating lesions that burst and hemorrhage within a few days to a week. 15% of infected, though admitted to a hospital, have died. That's 15%. You get that? 15%. 65 to 70% of infected, if denied hospital care or proper medical care. See, let's go back a little. 15% that have been admitted to a hospital have died. 65 to 75% of infected, if denied hospital or proper medical care, have died. Now, this is data that has came out of China. The number of infected is multiplying by 10 every 6 days. I don't mean it's adding 10. Like, if today it's 10 people infected, in 6 days it's 20 people. No, it's 10 times that. So today is 10. In 6 days, it's 60. The population of Wuhan is over 6 million people. There are over 200 people dying daily in Wuhan. Bodies are being cremated. All of this data, I've had for 4 days, and I had no way to get it to you guys. And slowly, it's popping out. But the problem is you get a little bit of information from CNN, then you get a little bit of information from One American News, then a little bit from Fox, then a little bit from this, and then blah, 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 blah. Unless you put it all together, you won't know the reality. The data that I'm telling you came out of China covertly. Police are sending... They closed the hospitals. The hospitals are frantic. There are people, doctors are dying within the hospitals in China. Out of 31 provinces in China, 29 of them are known to have infected cases in them. Police are boarding up houses of the sick and dying and burning them down. They picked this up on satellites. On Tuesday, January 28th, China claimed 7,000 people were infected within their borders. On Wednesday, January 29th, China added another 12,000 to the infected. This is not being reported outside of China. All that's being reported outside of China is now they have 12,000 infected, not 7,000. Over 60 million people in 17 Chinese cities are in complete citywide quarantine. The roads are physically blocked. No vehicles or people allowed in or out. There are massive food riots, murder, robbing, you name it, going on inside of China right now. China's collapsing. Now, not the whole country, but the majority of it is. The Wuhan novel coronavirus is spreading in a geometrical progression. An arithmetical progression is 1 plus 1 is 2, 2 plus 1 is 3, 3 plus 1 is 4. A geometrical progression is 2 plus 2 is 4, 4 plus 4 is 8, 8 plus 8 is 16, 16 plus 16 is 32. You get the idea? That's how it's progressing. The average hospital beds available in first world nation, and I'm talking the United States, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, is about 7 beds per 1,000 population. Now, this is some numbers that are just kind of freaky. 7 beds per 1,000 population. The U.S. has a population of over 330 million citizens. That would equate to 2.3 million hospital beds in the U.S. Now, if we use the lower infection rate of the 1918 Spanish flu, which killed over 15 million people worldwide, its infection rate was 1.5%. Now, that's the lower rate. That would equate to an infection level of 4.9 million people. That's twice as many people sick as we have hospital beds available in the United States. The Wuhan novel coronavirus has an infection rate of between 2 and 5%. The bottom line is that this Wuhan novel coronavirus is a Chinese manufactured bioweapon. It was created using the original AVP78033.1 virus that was registered in the U.S. National Library of Science, and it has been obviously modified. My suggestion to you guys, watch the 2011 movie Outbreak. I did, and the similarities are freakishly astounding. Now, I've talked to you till I'm blue in the face about being prepared for things, right? That's just logical. And I told you what's going to happen. I told you the stock market was going to crash on the last show. I told you that. Well, here's something else that's happening. Now, I only have a few more minutes before we get into the meat of the show, which is going to be more on drugging. We talked about children being drugged last week. Now it's going to be the military and the police. The thing is, we had Brexit. Brexit, this is when the UK split from the communist nation, the EU, the European Union. It happened Friday night at midnight. And now we have a combination of Brexit. So the UK is really confused about the economy and what's going to happen to them. And over the weekend, I guarantee you, there's going to be data released or discovered that talks more about this virus. We have a dozen people minimum in the United States right now that have been verified as infected. When 2% of the infected people don't show any symptoms, yet are contagious, that's a whole new ballgame. So I'm telling you right now, Monday and Tuesday could be, not will be, they could be a very bad time for the economy and for you thinking of going shopping and getting food. So in other words, what I'm saying to you is if you can, turn me off. Listen to me later. Go to Costco. Go to any stores that you can go to and stock up on food. Nothing's coming from China. The ships, and that's another thing, Baltic Dry Index. Now, I've talked about that before. The Baltic Dry Index is an index of basically the money that's being made by these giant supercargoes that's bringing shipping ingredients across the ocean. By ingredients, I mean basics, like iron ore and aluminum and fiber and wheat and things like that. It's dropped. It's been dropping for the past year. It is now the lowest it's ever been, which is 525. The Baltic's index is just caved in. The only thing coming from China is what's on the water right now, because they've locked down all the ports. When they told Wuhan to, you're going to quarantine, we're going to quarantine tomorrow. So there are hundreds of airplanes that came into the U.S., and for that matter, are still coming into the U.S., that could potentially have infected people on it. Now, I hate to say this, and it's going to sound racist, but it's all Chinese. Even though it's been proven that it does have human-to-human infection, not just animal-to-human. It's Chinese. And this is unfortunate, but I'm sorry, you know, you got to call a spade when you see one. And when the reality is that 99% of all infected are Chinese, or is it 99.9% are all Chinese? And every nation on Earth has an infected person in it, at least one. Every single nation. So all of these planes headed to the U.S., hundreds of thousands left by road before the quarantine hit. Russia closed their borders with China. The Chinese came out this week and said, oh, yeah, yeah, look at what we got. We're building these new hospitals, how great they are, blah, blah, blah. Phony pictures. Who declares a virus is a global epidemic? And then Trump declares this virus is a public health emergency in the U.S. Do you know we have over 500,000 Chinese students in the United States on student visas? Problem that we have. Now, Trump also is blocking all Chinese, basically, from flying into the United States. Any of you who live in areas that are highly populated by Chinese, I would advise you lock down now. I mean, I hate to say this, because I have listeners that are Chinese. I have friends and customers that are Chinese. But this is Chinese New Year. It's a Lunar New Year. So they're going to be celebrating it. This is the year of the rat, or Schumer, whichever word you like to interject. And the problem that we have is that a lot of their relatives are flying over here for celebrations. So the main transportation hubs, which is New York City, Chicago, Miami, Seattle, Portland, Oregon, believe it or not, Sacramento, Los Angeles, look for airports that have direct flights from China. This is not going to get better. This is going to get worse. Watch the movie Outbreak. Or is it Contagion? Now I forgot. So there's two movies. Okay, one's called Outbreak. The other's called Contagion. Yeah, Contagion was made in 2011, and Outbreak was made in 1995. The 2011 one more parallels this Wuhan novel coronavirus. All right, so I don't have too many more minutes left, but I want to get into a few things here just so that you guys have the data. There's a security program out there called Avast. In fact, it's embedded in a lot of computers that you buy now, AVAST. I had it years ago, and it was a pain in the butt, and it was almost impossible to delete and remove from my computer. But if you have Avast, you want to remove it. It is selling your data. Everything that you do, every keystroke you make, they sell it to Google and I mean, you name it, they sell it. And Ring, by the way, there's these Ring doorbells that I like so much. They allow Facebook to access them and download all your data. They can view, okay? The Ring has cameras on, and it sees people walking up to the door, and it sees the street, and it sees the cars, and it sees the grass. It sees everything out there, and then it sells that data to Facebook, which then evaluates via facial recognition who comes to your door, and when did you get the last package, and driver's license plates of vehicles that drive by. So they even know where you live, kind of, sometimes, and they can hear everything. So Avast is handing out your data. Ring, obviously, is handing out your data and has been for a long time. Now, under the Food and Health Department, we have, Africa has its share of problems, and it always has. But now they have a plague of billions of locusts. You've heard of these happening before. This is eating everything out in sight. And this is in East Africa. Farms are being completely wiped out. This is wiping out areas the size of cities. And there's nothing they can do about it. They're breeding. So it could be trillions of locusts. I don't know. And this is East Africa. And you know what's going to happen. It's going to move west. And it's going to screw up all kinds of things. Cold records are being set. You know, anybody out there who still is insane enough to believe in this so-called global warming deserves to have a Democrat as a president. The Magadan and Ukisha region in Russia. Picture waking up in the morning, turning TV on, and the pretty weather lady says, oh, it's going to be negative 56 today. With the wind chill, negative 71. Negative. And this is the area where Russia is, west of Alaska. Negative. That's just astounding. Virginia is passing a bill that's going to allow the state to vaccinate your children without your knowledge or consent. Under the category of liberal psychosis, you know, the party of racism, intolerance, anger, hate, and fear, I heard this and I got so mad, I researched it and discovered it's true. I like hummus. And Sabra, S-A-B-R-A, makes hummus. It turns out Sabra is going to have an ad on the Super Bowl. Sabra is going to have an ad in the Super Bowl. Going to be promoting drag queens. So they're going to promote sexual perversion on the Super Bowl. Now, the Super Bowl wouldn't allow the NRA to have an ad, but they allow this kind of El Toro caca. Speaking of that, Denver schools are going to have gender-neutral bathrooms. Now, you know what that is? Now, when I was a kid, we had gender-neutral bathrooms. In fact, most houses have a gender-neutral bathroom. You know what that means? There's no urinal on a wall. So you just have a toilet sitting there. But this is a big thing. Denver, they're like little tiny miniature California. In fact, in California, the eighth graders in California are now going to be taught sexual perversion. Not just it's okay to be a pervert, but how to be one. And the different ways to be a sexual pervert. This is California. Something for you guys in California. This you're not going to like in any way, shape, or form. They're passing a gun show ban. Basically, what they're going to be doing in California is banning all gun shows in state-owned property of agricultural based. See, the largest auditoriums are agricultural based auditoriums. We're talking like the Cow Palace in San Francisco. Senate Bill 281. Of course it passed, 27-11. So now it goes to the Assembly for further consideration. What they're doing is they're banning any property owned, occupied, operated, or controlled by the Agricultural Association. That includes the Cow Palace, the largest gun show in the state of California. Not just a Cow Palace. There's gun shows in Fresno, in Stockton, in Sacramento, in areas not owned by Agricultural Association. So that's going to shut down a 100-year-old gun show. Now, here's something I'm going to back up. You know, Survival Enterprises, which is my company, has, until about 6 or 7 years ago, we were the second largest emergency food supplier in the United States. And then some wannabe pops in, and he has a lot of money, and he's just north of me here. He has a lot of money, and he comes online, and he fraudulently advertises that he has the lowest prices, and that he's a survival expert, and that he's this, and he's that, and he's got all of this crap that he's advertising fraudulently. Okay, so he's making money. That's fine. Unfortunately, every time there's a giant flood or a giant earthquake or some kind of devastating occurrence, he comes out and he starts passing lies around. Like, oh, the government's buying up all my food, so you guys need to buy food quickly because the government's buying it all. Well, he's pulling that crap again now. And he's come out, he's even been on Alex Jones, of course. Of course, Alex Jones is what we call the Patriot whore. He sells anything, as long as he makes money at it. So this guy comes on. Now, this is something that it happened years ago when he showed up. Patriot Foods. So he comes on and says, oh yeah, the Department of Defense is buying all my food up, so you guys, you know, I can't supply everybody with food. Well, that's a lie. Before that, a couple years before that, he come out and claimed that FEMA was buying all his food. And he showed a phony letter from FEMA saying that they wanted to buy all his food. I deal with FEMA, so I know that that was fraud. Don't get sucked into that kind of crap. These guys are self-serving liars. We have all kinds of stuff going on. We have the president's impeachment, which has failed again. The Democrats are not going to give up. They are the evil that walks on two legs in the United States. In other parts of the world, they're called communists or socialists. But we have to call them Democrats here. I don't. I call them whatever I want to call them. But they are not going to give up. This so-called impeachment, which was never valid in the first place, started before Trump was even sworn in 3 years ago. And they're going to keep it up and keep it up and keep it up until either the Democrats take over the House and the Senate and the presidency, because that's only when they're going to stop, or the Republicans take over the House, the Senate, and the presidency at the same time. That's the only way in time it's going to stop. Believe nothing, and I'm going to end with this part. Believe nothing that you hear on the news. Believe nothing that you are listening to on any of the stations, ABC, CBS, MSNBC, even Fox. Don't believe what you're hearing. Fox comes out and says, oh, we have a new new poll that shows the president is down 75% or some such crap. It is that. It is just that. It's crap. It's not real. It's phony. I saw a cartoon a couple weeks ago. Here was this factory, this floor of a factory, and there was like 800 people on the floor of the factory working. They have a radio playing so that the, you know, people can hear the talk show, whatever the talk show is that's on. And all of these people are busting their butts, and they're all got this full-time jobs, and on the radio it's saying, yeah, the economy's doing really bad. Nobody's getting any good jobs, and people are starving, and we need equality, and we need freedom, and we need, and all these people stop working and look up, go, what the hell are they talking about? That's what's happening. The Democrats in the United States are coming out and saying, everything is sour. Everything smells bad. Nothing's working. Nobody has a job. Everybody hates Trump. They're coming out. This is pure communist propaganda. It's been done in every nation on earth that has succumbed to the entitlement games of, oh, let the government take care of you. You know, from birth, cradle to grave, they say, from cradle to grave. And then you end up being like in the Matrix, sitting in a pool of nutritious goo with leads hooked to you, and some strange computer is using your nerves to generate electricity to feed the computer. I mean, you're nothing but a bag of blood that can be sucked on by the current government so that they can survive. They don't care what happens to you. This is the sad thing. All governments rule by fear. And when fear doesn't work, they use propaganda. But propaganda only works on people of limited or low intelligence. That's why it works on all Democrats. This has been proven. This was proven, I think it was proven in the 70s, either in the late 60s or the early 70s. They actually did standardized IQ testing on thousands and thousands of people nationwide. You had to claim that you're very political. They looked for people who were very political. They discovered that the Republicans actually had a minimum of 10 points of IQ rating above all of the ones that claimed they were Democrats. And that's how it averaged out. Now, I've also been told that Republicans are more fun. Republicans enjoy life more. But what happens is propaganda works on those of lower intelligence because they don't pay attention to life. They don't learn as much as they can. And they end up being able to fall for anything. What my grandpa used to say, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. There is a lot going on. We have the economy in the United States, the stock market, which is not the United States economy. The stock market is a bunch of computers buying and selling stuff based on data that these computers aggregate over the weeks from all over the world, from other computers. So we have the stock market in the United States that's getting spastic right about now. The Chinese stock market is closed, by the way, so we can't get any judgment off of that. We have this virus that came out of China, 100% created by the Chinese government. Now remember, these are communists. But also remember, the United States has biological warfare labs all over the United States as well. We're not any better than the Chinese, except we haven't been caught. Nothing's broke loose yet, as far as I know. So you all take care. Pay attention to what's going on around you. If you see somebody fall, I know you're going to want to help people. If somebody is walking and they just drop to the ground, run. If a vehicle crashes and you stop to help and you see somebody in there that looks as though they've been hemorrhaging blood from their face, from their mouth, their nose, their eyes, run. People are dying in China with no symptoms. The Wuhan coronavirus, when it attacks you, it attacks your lungs and your kidneys, and it creates lesions on them that will burst, and that's when you start hemorrhaging blood. And this is why the initial videos coming out of China showed people laying in the streets in puddles of blood. I hope I've scared the hell out of you. I want you to be aware. Step it up. Pay attention. Get the stuff that you need to get. If you were saying to yourself, I think next month I'm going to go buy me a 12-pack of underwear or a new pair of shoes or another jacket or another gun or some ammo or something, don't wait because it might be too late. You might not be able to. Don't think just because they quarantine in some strange communist country, they won't do it here. I've been in a quarantine. I had the plague when I was a kid. They quarantined the whole city block and they had police sitting around there so nobody would go in and nobody would come out.
All right, power's back on. Windstorm's still doing 50 to 60 mile an hour gusts up here. but I'm back in the studio on a proper microphone. I want to apologize for all the snap, crackle, and pops you're going to hear in the first part, or you did hear in the first part of the show. It's just very bad. The microphone was bad, and the environment was bad, and there was a lot of static electricity there. I hope you got the idea what I'm trying to get across to you guys. Prepare as fast as you can. You know, there's not a definite something's going to happen, but there's something might happening. Now, second part of the show is about drugging of our military. You'll understand exactly what I'm talking about. And those of you who have come back from Iraq and Afghanistan, you know what I'm talking about. This might explain to you why cops, not all of them, but many of them, just sort of put a bullet in the back of somebody's head just because they're there and then laugh about it. I don't know about you, but I actually saw that on video. This is a show that I did probably 10 years ago, 9 years ago, but it's something that you all need to listen to.
There's certain kinds of human beings, and I don't like using the word human, but there's certain kinds of beings that have been around this planet for millennium, thousands and thousands and thousands of years. Either by themselves or in small groups, they've been attempting total control over all of the known population, not based on leadership skills, but totalitarian power, threats, food control, which they're using now, monetary and economic control, which they're using now, threat of diseases, which they're using now, or withholding of knowledge. Knowledge is power. In the late 1800s, they saw the light at the end of the tunnel when a Russian Jew created something called psychiatry. And it's strange because psyche is soul and iatry is study of. See, that's the thing with psychiatry. Psychiatrists and anything that has to do with psychiatry, you don't have a soul. You are a body. You're a mud creature that is a stimulus response mechanism, period. You have no soul. So when they use the term soul or mind, they're talking about body or brain. But this Russian Jew discovered this system by where he could control people. That was the key. It was created in Russia to control people. That so-called science has been improving and has been exported to all countries on the planet. It gained a foothold in the U.S. Maybe it's a coincidence, maybe it isn't, I don't know. This is the history. This is the actual history. This rich Jewish industrialist, they created these places called Teachers College. They gained control totally, 100% of the public school system. Before then, it was a little, you know, the brick schoolhouse. Every city had one. They created a public school system. The corporate government, which had already been taken over since 1871, needed a way to control the population. So they put psychology, the psychiatry, into these teachers' colleges. It's a control system. The whole intent is to breed ignorant drones. Kind of difficult until the 60s when they started to research psychedelic drugs. But these drugs, they had a hard time getting them into the public. So they had the assistance of the corporate government, the CIA, the FBI, to push these drugs, to have them grown, created, and then leaked into the public, LSD, and on and on and on. And then psychiatry gained foothold into the military, and then this conspiracy started to unfold. The key is that drugging had to gain respectability and acceptance of the general public. So for the past 40 years, you've been watching this evil philosophy called psychiatry. It's not a philosophy. It's a control mechanism like Islam is. It's got into the military, the public. Turn the TV on. You see it all the time. The school system, the healthcare, TV, magazines, newspapers, radios, all of them. They use the term mental health. But in reality, what that means is drug into oblivion. And it's become acceptable. We go to a clinic here in Coeur d'Alene. Two-thirds of the funding for this clinic is their quote-unquote mental health department. Do you know what that is? You get some guy calls himself a psychiatrist. And you go in and say, my dog died and I'm really upset. Oh, no problem, dude. Here, have this prescription for Prozac. And you might as well fill the whole year at once. That's psychiatry. So you have the government, our federal government, gearing up for war against the citizens. I want you to listen to this. You can choose to not to. When I'm editing this, there were half a dozen times I had to stop because there were tears in my eyes because I've seen it. This is called the hidden enemy.
They protect us. They defend us. They help us in times of need. But they're being destroyed from within.
Last year saw more Army suicides than any year on record.
Day.
Our son was just one of thousands of veterans that this country has lost to suicide.
After day.
Only to die here at home in their sleep.
After day.
He then used a pistol to take his own life.
There is a hidden enemy at work.
It's got to stop.
and it's hiding in plain sight. The most dangerous enemy is the one you never suspect. June 18th, 1940. Psychiatrist and Brigadier General J.R. Reese addressed the annual meeting of the National Council for Mental Hygiene with a strategic plan for psychiatry.
We must aim to make it permeate every educational activity in our national life. Public life, politics, and industry should all of them be within our sphere of influence.
But to reach their objectives, psychiatrists needed the perfect proving ground, one with an unlimited budget that could keep on growing.
It's all about money.
Billions. Billions of dollars.
It's our tax money.
A proving ground with an endless supply of human resources.
More people than any other organization in America.
These troops are the guinea pigs.
They're being experimented on.
A proving ground where every order is obeyed, no questions asked.
They have to obey those orders.
You don't have an option.
I'm legally obligated.
And a proving ground where any collateral damage would be labeled classified.
This story has been censored every step of the way.
Brigadier General Reese knew where to look.
The Army and the other fighting services form rather unique experimental groups, since they are complete communities, and it is possible to arrange experiments in a way that would be very difficult in civilian life.
It was a shrewd tactic, especially when sold under the guise of health.
And now a soldier is sick, and unless we do something for him, he may remain sick for an indefinite period of time. Gentlemen, you are not requested to treat these patients. You are directed to do so.
Psychiatrists had come a long way. Only 20 years earlier, they were almost unheard of in military life.
It wasn't until World War I that they came out of the asylums and sort of worked their way into the military. It was a very slow, very gradual insertion.
Slow and gradual, because psychiatrists were simply not trusted, and for good reason. Their treatments were never known to be scientific. In fact, many of their experimental procedures would later be labeled torture.
One of the first uses of psychiatric treatment actually goes back to World War I, when it was used on German soldiers who were deserting and trying to leave the front because of the horrors of the trench warfare on the Western Front.
This treatment was dubbed Kaufman Cure after its inventor, but few would have called it therapeutic. The traumatized soldier was hooked up to an electric current, which was ratcheted up until he couldn't take it any longer. During this, the practitioner laid in hypnotic suggestions. But the pain these soldiers suffered didn't prevent psychiatrists from continuing their experimentation into World War II. And just as before, it was not designed to help their patients overcome the trauma of war. All around the world, psychiatrists used the war as an opportunity to try some very risky treatments on soldiers who had very little to say in the matter. They were electroshocking some, putting others into a deep coma, and filling yet more with powerful, mind-altering drugs. As they infiltrated further and further, they became involved in military recruitment, training, discipline, morale. They were even making opinions about the selection of officers. By 1943, psychiatry had penetrated so deeply into the American military, the Navy's top psychiatrist bragged,
"Psychiatry now has a place in every step of the Navy man's career, from his induction to his eventual separation from the service."
It is because of the military that psychiatrists, they became important. You know, they're wearing a uniform now, and they've got the epaulets, and, you know, they've got some power because of the military. The military gave them that.
The United States Chief Military Psychiatrist, Brigadier General William Menninger, even wrote a manual listing all the mental problems he thought soldiers could have. But there were no blood tests, no x-rays, nothing observed under a microscope. Just opinions. Scientific evidence? No, sir. But this only helped psychiatry. After all, Menninger's Army Manual provided a veneer of legitimacy, something they could use to diagnose and treat even more service members. The Army Manual was so widely used, it became the foundation for psychiatry's Bible, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM.
Because of the influence of people like Menninger, by the middle of World War II, militaries around the world were buying into psychiatrists' claims that they were the mental health experts. And because of that, psychiatrists were free to try out drugs on a lot more soldiers.
During the Second World War, both Americans and Germans experimented with stimulants. Because everybody said, this is great, you know, it helps you focus, it keeps you awake.
One such drug was Pervitin, which was given to German soldiers to lower inhibitions and increase aggressiveness. Stimulants were also used by the Japanese. They gave its fighters instant courage. From the 50s through the 70s, psychiatrists in countries like Britain, the United States, and the USSR continued to use their militaries as proving grounds for an arsenal of new experimental treatments. American military psychiatrists used soldiers to experiment with LSD. Even though they knew the dangers of this drug, British psychiatrists continued the LSD testing. Soviet psychiatrists gave their soldiers God knows what. Up through time, soldiers continue to be given psychiatric drugs for uses never studied or approved. It's been one huge experiment.
In the Falklands campaign, air crew were given uppers and downers so that their flight duty rotas could be maximized.
We've gotten reports that the Gulf War II pilots do take amphetamines, they do take dexedrine, and that at the nighttime they're given Ambien to bring them down so they can sleep. So they're continuously on this up and down kind of scenario.
Certainly in the Iraq-Afghanistan wars, psychiatry has played a huge role.
Huge.
Psychiatry is now an accepted part of militaries around the world. We're told we should trust psychiatrists, that they're the authorities. Only one problem, though. Things haven't gotten better. They've only gotten worse.
I spent almost 26 years on active duty in the Marine Corps. I retired with the grade of Brigadier General.
I was an Army captain in the aviation branch.
I was a Staff Sergeant E5 in the United States Air Force.
I was in the United States Marine Corps from 2007 to 2011.
Florida Army National Guard.
31st Engineering Battalion.
I was an aviation and military intelligence.
Battlefield intelligence analyst.
I was a U.S. Navy fighter pilot. Combat
medic. I got out as a sergeant, non-commissioned officer this past March.
I didn't see the emergence of psychiatry in the Army up until I suffered my own injury. Then it was like it was a flood. It was a flood of doctors and it was a flood of meds.
There's just as much stress on today's soldier as in the past. Long hours, grueling missions, extended periods away from loved ones. And when mental and emotional problems strike, there's no doubting their reality. But no matter where soldiers go for help, in today's military, they often end up in the hands of a psychiatrist.
You can go to a chaplain, and a chaplain is just somebody that you can talk to. I think part of the issue is that a chaplain is kind of obligated to route you straight to a psychiatrist if you mention any keywords, you know? Like, yeah, I have been stressed out or something like that.
If you tell a therapist you're depressed, they're going to send you to a psychiatrist. It's going to happen. Just how it works.
So they'll make a real quick decision on you have a problem or what the problem might be within just minutes. So 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes, if you're lucky, 45 minutes in the office.
Standard practice for a psychiatrist is first to diagnose you with a mental disorder. He might tell you that you have a chemical imbalance in the brain, even though he hasn't done any tests to prove it, and he never will, because there is no test. In fact, there are no tests for practically any of the hundreds of mental illnesses listed in psychiatry's diagnostic manual.
Psychiatry, especially, has no objective means of making any diagnosis. In general medicine, at least you have x-rays and blood tests to go on. And so that's the big, big dilemma faced by psychiatry. They have zero ability to diagnose, so they have zero ability to treat.
No physical abnormality has ever been found. So there is no physical abnormality to demonstrate by an MRI, a CT, an EEG. It's another fraud.
So, psychiatrists are diagnosing you with brain diseases, physical things wrong with your brain that they can't even prove exist.
There were no medical tests of any kind. There were no blood tests.
Nothing that I could tell that was scientific in any way or medical in any way.
Somebody suggests that you have a disorder, a disease or something, there should be some sort of objective test. It's not unreasonable to ask for it. It's not unreasonable to insist on it.
But you won't get one from psychiatrists, only their opinions. And they won't be shy about giving those.
There are troops that are seeing psychiatrists who are automatically, before they even open up their mouth, being diagnosed just because of the way how they look.
The psychiatrist told me that I would never amount to anything in the military again because of the emotional trauma I experienced and my current depression levels, my stress, my anxiety. I was never going to accomplish anything in the military. I would never be a good soldier again. And the only viable option that the military saw was to discharge me.
A psychiatrist says your life is not worth anything because it's been all some sort of psychosis or some sort of trauma event, or you've got this disease or that, or some brain chemical or whatever. A soldier's life turns into nothing.
Every year, thousands of men and women in uniform are diagnosed with a mental illness, sometimes even two or three. This has gotten so out of control that the U.S. Pentagon now spends $2 billion a year on mental health alone. And the Veterans Administration's mental health budget has gone ballistic, shooting up from less than $3 billion in 2007 to nearly $7 billion in 2014. That's a lot of money to spend on a profession that can't even find evidence for its brain diseases under a microscope. Not that this matters to psychiatrists. The diagnosis is only a first step, actually an excuse to get you onto some very dangerous treatments.
I joined the Navy when I was 17. I was medically discharged, I should say, from the SEAL teams. I served my country with America's best in a time of war, and I had the honor of leading them. But I did lose my swim buddy, which is a guy you go through SEAL training with. And that gave me a survivor's guilt that I can't begin to describe. You know, I make it through combat and multiple firefights and nothing. I got blown up by an IED, it broke my neck, you know, and I didn't know it at the time. I lived with that for like 5 years, make it through all of that. And I come back and they almost kill me with pills.
The almost inevitable result of a psychiatric diagnosis is a prescription for a psychiatric drug. There's very little else psychiatrists do. And they've been prescribing a lot. From 2005 to 2011, the U.S. Department of Defense increased its prescriptions of psychiatric drugs by nearly 7 times. That's over 30 times faster than civilians. The drug push is no different for veterans.
We get this guy from the Veterans, I think the Veterans Administration or something like that, and he's basically telling you, if you are depressed, if you do something erratic, it's a disease. This guy's literally the loudest guy in the entire briefing. Very in your face about it. And he's just basically saying, you know, if you're doing anything other than what you normally do, you have a disease and you need to be put on the system. You need drugs.
And right after that, they're going to get prescribed whatever drug the psychiatrist seems fit, rather than just being able to talk to somebody.
No therapy, no lifestyle change. It's a straight line of how they educate these doctors in pharmacology, a symptom to a drug.
Psychiatrists have no real idea of what their drugs are doing to the human body, but when it comes to handing them out, that hardly mattered.
My older brother got out of the Marine Corps, like I said, about a year ago. When he went to the VA hospital to make his disability claim and talk to him, he told him that he had trouble sleeping. He didn't tell me what they gave him, but he basically said they gave him a big bag of Happy Pills.
So I came home, an R&R from Iraq, got severely depressed, and they went and told me to go see a psychologist, which then they prescribed me meds.
He basically told me what was wrong with me, prescribed me with Zoloft, and that was pretty much it.
I've been on Ambien, Seroquel, Paxil. That was one of the big ones. Very dangerous drug that I just think is very harmful, called Abilify. It kind of puts whatever meds you're on steroids. Wellbutrin, Zoloft, Modafinil, Methylphenidate, Trazodone, Prednisone, and Ambien.
Starts out with Dexedrine,
Vibrid,
Dalmane,
Citalopram,
Thorazine,
Citalopram,
Prozac,
and Effexor at the same time,
Stelazine,
Zoloft,
Compazine,
Seroquel,
Cogentin,
Abilify,
Nodular,
Wellbutrin,
IV Amitol,
Depakote,
Artane,
Xanax,
Haloperidol or Haldol,
Clonopin,
Temazepam,
Adderall,
and Librium.
From 5 milligrams to 300.
300 milligrams.
1,200 milligrams of lithium a day. Most individuals who would be given these drugs have no clue what the drug is or what it can do to the mind. They just don't know. It's a blind date, and sometimes it turns out to be kind of an ugly one.
The drugging of the military is off the charts, especially in the United States. In total, over the last 10 years, the U.S. government has spent more than $4.5 billion just medicating soldiers and veterans. In fact, in 2011, the Pentagon spent more on pills, injections, and vaccines than on Black Hawk helicopters, Abrams tanks, Hercules C-130 cargo planes, and Patriot missiles combined.
The use of both psychiatry and psychotropic drugs has just ballooned in the U.S. military.
Every soldier that I've talked to, every time they've seen a psychiatrist, they would prescribe them some kind of psychotropic drug right off the bat.
I would say 60-70% of the soldiers we saw in our center were on medication.
Let me give you an example. I was on a scholarship committee for veterans at a college, and they invited the VA psychiatrist to come in to give a talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. But at the very end, I raised my hand, I said, how many of your veterans that you see do you medicate? And initially he tried to skirt the answer. He said, I see the most difficult. And I said, we all see the most difficult. How many do you medicate? 98%. It's criminal.
And it isn't much better in the rest of the world.
I deal a lot with a lot of our soldiers within our NATO brothers and sisters. Canada, New Zealand, Australia, UK, Germany, France, Belgium, and even soldiers down in Italy and even in Spain. Each and every one of them have complained about the issues dealing with psychotropic drugs with them.
I was stationed in Germany for a while. I was in Kosovo for a while. And they had talked about that, yeah, when they see the psychiatrist, they do give them psychotropic drugs. So it seems like it's a worldwide problem.
A lot of our veterans have told us that when they went for help whilst they were still serving, they were then prescribed medication. It didn't help.
But no matter the country, this is the military. And in the military, soldiers have no choice but to follow orders.
When I'm wearing this uniform, if I'm ordered to see a psychiatrist, I have to go see a psychiatrist.
The suggestion to go see the psychiatrist came across as a heavy recommendation. It wasn't a direct order, but it was, this is something you should go do. It's something that needs to be handled. You should go do this.
And then there's the pressure put on you to take the drugs.
I actually asked my commander that, do I have to take these drugs? Is this an order? And they all just stared at me, wouldn't give me a no or a yes. Implied that I'm supposed to take this. I would have refused, probably would have lost my rank or lost opportunities in the military because I wasn't taking care of the property of the military, which was my body.
Most of the troops that I talked with did not want to take the psychiatric drugs, did not want them, did not need them, and rebelled at having to take them. But they were told that if you don't take these drugs, you can't get your compensation and you can't get any more VA treatment if you deny the drug usage. So they did.
I have heard that military personnel have been ordered to take these drugs. My response to that is, that's an illegal order, and I had that verified by a judge advocate general right here in Washington, D.C. It's illegal to demand that. If a psychologist tells you that you have to take it or you're going to lose your benefits, you need to report that psychologist to the proper authorities.
Officially, one in six American service members is on at least one psychiatric drug. But here's the thing. According to the Armed Services Committee of the United States Senate, no one knows how many drugs are given to soldiers downrange. There's no paper trail, no prescriptions. They're just handed out. Fact is, the amount of psychiatric drugging in the military is probably much, much higher. Particularly when so many qualify for psychiatry's biggest diagnosis drugging combo of all.
I was in the Army, and when I got out, I was corporal. And then I went back as a contractor for the Department of the Army. My original purpose was definitely get involved, serve my country, and then pursue it from that point forward. I personally had been deployed to Iraq for just about a year, and having gone back to Europe, I was having trouble sleeping and having some issues just adjusting back to this, you know, different lifestyle after having been shot at, nearly blown to pieces. you know, so many times to this, now I can just go down the road and get a pizza. And one of my officers recommended I go see a psychiatrist. Yeah, within 10 minutes it was, so you're probably bipolar, most likely ADD, and PTSD.
The visible effects of combat stress have been mentioned by ancient writers like Homer and Herodotus. The French called it mal de pays. The Germans, Heimweh. In Spain, it was estar roto. Whatever they've called it, centuries of militaries have acknowledged that sometimes the horrors of war can be too much for soldiers to bear. It used to be considered a nervous reaction, an expected part of combat. But psychiatrists today label it a brain dysfunction, which began life in 1980 as post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD.
This war isn't any different than any other than guys coming back with shell shock, battle fatigue, or combat fatigue. You know, now they're calling it post-traumatic stress disorder. It's been around forever.
And like their other disorders, it wasn't found through scientific testing. It was lobbied for by psychiatrists and voted into psychiatry's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. Literally voted in. Today, it's military psychiatry's most popular diagnosis, and it spread rapidly into the civilian world.
The goal is to combat post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD.
Helping veterans with PTSD.
A soldier's post-traumatic stress disorder.
I was diagnosed with PTSD.
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 How many times do you hear PTSD in the media now? People really don't understand it, I don't think, and we're just trying to assign a label to people, our soldiers and sailors that are coming back from these very horrific events that they're being witness to.
People who suffer from post-traumatic stress are reacting to a traumatic event in a normal fashion. What we believe is that the military is treating veterans in particular with post-traumatic stress as though they have a mental illness. We don't believe they have a mental illness. We believe that they're wounded and what they need is healing.
In PTSD, psychiatry has created a disease. They speak of it as a disease just as they speak of generalized anxiety disorder and clinical depression as diseases, but none of them are actual diseases.
If someone shows up in my practice and they say a psychiatrist or other doctor diagnosed me with post-traumatic stress disorder, I would actually ask the patient, well, okay, what tests were done to establish that diagnosis? And they'll think about it and they'll realize that nothing was done. They just got the opinion of whoever the practitioner was.
Certainly there is stress that goes along with combat. When you put a soldier into an environment where he's not getting sleep, he's being shot at, friends around him are getting hurt or dying, that's going to cause some bad side effects. Sure, those phenomena exist, but that doesn't then equate to, well, let's drug him.
There's nothing fake about the horrors of combat stress. But for psychiatry to invent a medical-sounding brain dysfunction to convince you to accept their supposed treatment, and then they continue to expand its definition wider and wider.
What qualifies for PTSD has recently been downgraded, but they have directives that come out that say, well, now we're going to suggest that everybody who's been in a war zone could possibly, maybe, and so with that, anybody qualifies.
What I saw with the new privates coming in is they were just out of basic training and they were given psych drugs for PTSD, for being in basic training for 9 weeks.
I was diagnosed with PTSD because I came back and I was a little jittery, and it's just, I guess they said that I had PTSD from that, when it was just, I was still kind of trying to assimilate back into the scene of not being in combat, of not being over.
The determination that I had PTSD was almost made before I even walked into the office.
They told me that it was clear that I had post-traumatic stress disorder and that I needed medication to fix it.
Nearly every soldier in my company was diagnosed with PTSD. Nearly every soldier.
There are 175 different symptom combinations a psychiatrist can use to diagnose you with PTSD. No surprise, then, that 37% of recent war veterans are being treated for it. Once labeled, 80% will be given psychiatric drugs. Of those vets drugged, 89% are put on antidepressants and 34% powerful antipsychotics. Even after one of the world's top PTSD psychiatrists did a study admitting that antipsychotics don't work.
That just because a medication can be widely prescribed doesn't mean necessarily that it's really helpful for overall for the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder.
If psychiatrists bother to do standard medical testing, there's a chance they might find something physically wrong. Something that they would label PTSD, but is actual physical damage that can be verified with a brain scan. It's called traumatic brain injury, or TBI, and it's estimated that 320,000 soldiers have suffered from it.
Traumatic brain injury is an injury to the brain itself, either caused by a concussive blast or a closed head wound. There's some difficulty determining between traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress because the symptoms tend to mirror each other. Inability to focus, short-term memory loss, difficulty with rage or anger.
You're talking about a physical injury, an actual brain injury, as opposed to a mental health, a condition. You know, it's the two absolutely totally separate things.
I'm handling a girlfriend who's got traumatic brain injuries. He's labeled with PTSD, and he's got a lump of shrapnel in his head, you know? So, hang on. You don't get lumps of shrapnel flying into your head and embedding in your skull. Do not leave you with no effect on the brain. The brain's going to take a real hammering from that sort of thing.
Of course, most psychiatrists aren't going to spot TBI because they don't check for it. Instead, while the real problem escalates, they'll mask it all with medication, which can make things far, far worse.
I think my main goal of why I joined the military was the first thing is to get money for college. And then all my friends were going in and they were having a blast with it. And I just really wanted to do something more with my life and not just stay here in a small town and not do anything. I served in two branches of the military. I served in the Marine Corps and also the Army, and got out as a specialist also at E4. When I was in the Marine Corps, I never went and saw a psychologist, but when I was in the Army, they told me I had to go see one. At that point, he diagnosed me with PTSD and prescribed me Prozac and Wellbutrin in Iraq, still carrying a weapon, still in the combat zone. The doctor, psychologist, said that my anxiety and depression, everything, like stuff like that, should actually go away. And actually, it did not. It got worse.
The life of a soldier is demanding. You're trained to be alert, decisive, and focused, and in top physical and mental shape. It's a necessity. But psychiatric drugs can make you combat ineffective. Psychiatrists know this, but still claim they are therapeutic. Here's the reality.
All psychiatric meds are mind-altering drugs. People don't put that together. But they're mind-altering, and they have side effects. Disaster side effects.
One of the most significant problems about every psychotropic drug that I can think of, the stimulants, the tranquilizers, antipsychotics, mood modulators, are unpredictable. I can give the same drug to 20 different men, and they'll have 10 different reactions to it.
No one, not even the prescriber, knows what will happen with a psychiatric drug. Each one is different, and each has a long list of side effects written in small print on its package insert.
My friends that take the drugs that I'm prescribed have very bad balance, a terrible memory. They have different difficulty talking clearly, speaking clearly to each other.
Their reaction times are very slow, and they have a hard time concentrating.
It pretty much just erased all feelings that I had, so I was just there.
A lack of motivation, really. I just stopped caring.
I was constantly demotivated, very worn down all the time. I was constantly sleepy, like not tired, just sleepy. I could stop doing something and instantly fall asleep.
One minute you can be on patrol, next minute you'd be asleep. That's what those pills do to you. They make you tired.
I would get headaches, but it's not like a normal headache. It would be like sharp pains just zapping through my head.
My anxiety level was through the roof. I had heart problems. I put on 20 to 25 kilos of extra weight.
I probably gained 40 pounds over the course of that period of time.
I was up to almost 300 pounds. I was in metabolic syndrome. My adrenal system had completely shut down. My muscles had seemingly turned to water, and I could not lose weight for anything.
I can't ever think of anybody who's ever said, "I feel better. This has helped me." I can't honestly think of anybody who's ever said that to me. And I've
seen and talked to a lot of veterans in my town.
These are supposed to be the finest, most elite soldiers, you know, physical combat machines, and they're being given something that's harming them, that's destroying not only their body physically, but also their minds mentally.
Psychiatrists will tell you that the benefits of their drugs exceed the risks. This is garbage, and scientifically untrue. There have been large studies proving that psychiatric drugs like antidepressants work no better than a dummy sugar pill. But some of the drug side effects are not just harmful, they're deadly. On top of all the terrible side effects you can experience with psychiatric drugs is the strangest fact of all. They don't cure anything. So what do? They alter your behavior by deadening your feelings. This not only prevents a person from sorting things out, but numbs them to the world around them. There's even a name for it. Depersonalization.
I've had patients who've been given very large doses of psychoactive drugs over a period of about a year and basically destroyed their sense of self.
They don't care almost about anything. You could go up to someone and start yelling at them, and if they're on the large enough cocktail, they won't do anything. They become almost drones.
So they're literally lobotomizing our soldiers with these drugs. I'm sorry. I'm just being very direct and honest with my experience of over 200 injured warriors. It's almost like being in a mental hospital with lobotomies, lobotomized patients. I'm sorry. It's just awful.
And the depersonalization gets really dangerous when the drug creates another common side effect.
If someone is numbed like that, they're less likely to be concerned about the consequences of their behavior and might resort then to impulsive actions, violent actions.
Some of the effects of the drugs that we're aware of that the veterans we've dealt with have come across have been things like more anxiety, more anger.
They're having all these fits of anger, aggression, they're getting in fights with their significant other.
And of course what this has led to is just a really horrendous number of domestic shootings, domestic beatings, child, wife abuse.
The numbers back it up. Since 2006, violent sex crimes and domestic abuse in the military have increased more than 30%, and child abuse is up 43%, all while the psychiatric drugging of our troops has been going out the roof. And then there are the cases where a soldier under the influence of psychiatric drugs loses it all.
This one particular morning, the soldier was in our unit, and most of the soldiers in our unit are on some type of medication. She was waiting for the soldier, and when she walked in, he was locking and loading his weapon. And she asked him, "What are you doing?" And he looked at her, he said, "I don't know." And she said, "You were locking and loading," which means he's putting his ammo in his weapon. And she asked him, and she said, "What were you going to do?" He said, "I don't know, if I was just going to shoot myself, I'd shoot up everybody in this building and then myself." And we were there.
May 11th, 2009, Sergeant John Russell opens fire in an Army combat stress clinic in Baghdad. He kills two officers and three enlisteds. The day before, his psychiatrist had prescribed him antidepressants. March 11th, 2012, in a remote village in Afghanistan, Staff Sergeant Robert Bales murders 16. Nine were children. Before his murder spree, Bales had snorted the psychiatric drug Valium while also drinking alcohol. September 16th, 2013, Navy veteran Aaron Alexis brings a shotgun to Washington, D.C.'s Navy Yard, where he kills 12 people in cold blood. According to reports, Alexis had been prescribed the antidepressant trazodone.
He talked about it. He said he went to the VA and they would give him some medicine.
These are just a few of many in the hands of mental health professionals just prior to committing horrific acts of violence. There's Army Private First Class David Lawrence, who murdered a Taliban commander in his prison cell while on Zoloft and trazodone. Terrence Tyler, a former Marine who gunned down two co-workers, then himself, at a New Jersey supermarket. He had been diagnosed with major depression and was taking Prozac. And Eddie Ray Routh, who murdered a decorated Navy SEAL. He had just gotten out of a mental hospital 4 days earlier, where he had been treated for PTSD.
Drugs and weapons do not mix, okay? It's a recipe for disaster all by itself.
they're seeing things different. Their mind has been altered. The brain has been altered. Their judgment and reasoning is not what it would have been without these medications.
It's the mind that makes the decision when to shoot and what to shoot. It's the mind. If you alter the mind and you imbalance the mind, which is what psychiatric drugs do, you change the results of who or what gets shot on the battlefield or at home after the battle is over.
Psychiatric drugs don't cause violence only in soldiers. They provoke people from all walks of life to commit deadly mass shootings in our homes, workplaces, and schools. Then there's the matter of what they might do to themselves.
Ever since I was a little kid, I always loved the military. I loved the Army. I think I always knew that I wanted to, join. I just said, I wanted to go and experience it just to serve my country. And then I went to the recruiter station. I said, I want to jump out of airplanes and ride motorcycles. And right then they said, we got a job for you, But I did it, and it was good. It was right after combat. I started getting these dreams and flashbacks and all that stuff, and then kind of like big anxiety and all that stuff. And I went to my doc, and they said, yeah, we got to get you some meds, and they gave me them, and that was it. When you first start taking it, you feel great. Whoa. And then it just like, you get me into it, and then oh, let's take a higher dose.
In my experience, I didn't see anything helping at all. I felt like it was making everything worse.
I gained like 40 pounds taking the meds. We looked it up, and that one med, I don't remember what it was called, but it said it acted like you had like 1,500 calories every pill you took, and I had to take it 3 times a day.
If you missed a dose, then the whole family would know. The whole house would be kind of on edge because you couldn't talk to him. He would snap.
You take your meds and you can just start feeling it going down, and then you're just like, bam, and you're just you're a zombie,
It almost seemed like he just didn't care about life anymore. He wasn't himself.
My body was breaking down, and my wife, she's all into herbs, and she's saying, this isn't right. And then what? I was all fucking drunk, and the meds just taking that shit, and I just said, fuck it, I'm done. And I took my pistol and put it in my mouth, and she opened up the door. I said, someone's, we can do something, and it just didn't work,
I had to literally grab the weapon away from him because it probably would have happened.
That's why I said, I'm stopping taking all this shit. It's killing me. It's going to kill me. It's going to kill my wife.
That was the straw that broke the camel's back. It wasn't working, and something had to be done. I didn't want to lose my husband. I didn't want him to kill himself, and I didn't want to be killed as well in the process.
I knew I wasn't me. It was the drug that was doing it, and I knew I had to change, or I'd be dead, and that's why I changed it.
There is a huge problem with suicides in the military. Since 2002, the rate in the U.S. ranks has almost doubled.
The suicide rate has really been going out the roof here lately with our military members, both while they're still in and once they return back to the States.
I would move from base to base to base, and I'd be on different missions at different times. And one minute I'm on a base, and I'm having lunch, and I'm being asked, hey, did you hear about those three guys, those three soldiers that committed suicide?
It was a black eye on Fort Bliss. Soldiers were dying left and right. Preventable deaths, we're talking suicides, we're talking about these soldiers getting in their cars going, or motorcycles going 150 miles an hour and, hitting a median, family violence. It really spiraled out of control.
With all this happening, psychiatrists continue to hand out psychiatric drugs in volume. Drugs well known to increase violence and suicidal thinking.
My psychiatrist at the time had issued me a recommended gabapentin. I took one, and I think within 30 minutes, I had thoughts of suicide.
They started me on a really low dose to build it in my system, but even the low dose, I was still feeling side effects of suicide, depression, anxiety.
I did notice that there was a lot of times that I thought that it would just be better to be dead than to keep living like that. And I look back on it now, and I do realize that it was the meds.
Yes, there can be reasons for suicide in today's military that don't involve psychiatric drugs, but it would be stupid to ignore the drug's influence. Just ask the troops with boots on the ground.
It was military police actively working as a police officer on the military installation. In 1 week, I went to about 8 or 9 suicide attempts where the person either overdosed or said that he was going to kill himself, something like that. And one for one, every single person was on psychiatric drugs.
Because of my role as a criminal investigator, I didn't witness the soldiers while they were taking psychiatric drugs. All I got to see was after the suicide or after the death, and then the reports come out. We'd get called pretty often to investigate. We would have an autopsy performed and would include a toxicological exam, which would determine any drugs in the system, and usually there was some type of drug. A lot of them were taking some sort of medication for depression or anxiety. There were a lot of suicides happening in the military, overseas in theater, and back in the States.
From 2009 to 2012, more U.S. soldiers died by suicide than from traffic accidents, heart disease, cancer, and homicide. The U.S. Secretary of Defense called it an epidemic. So, yeah, it's a problem. Some have claimed that this is because of the stresses of war, but 85% of military suicides never even saw combat, and 52% never deployed. Meanwhile, the competence of military psychiatrists is never even questioned, and it's resulting in suicide attempts such as this one.
My son joined the Army, wanted to make a career and become something. He was still sweet and more normal when he came back from Iraq, even though he had, you know, nervousness in crowds and PTSD. He was not different in personality as far as, you know, to that degree, like what we saw later on the drugs.
And so when Michael said, hey, I'm, you know, having anxiety issues, I said, you need to go tell them. Well, and that's what really began his journey. That was the worst step, in my opinion, that we could have ever done. You know, it started off with one drug and went to two. With each successive symptom that he got a new drug.
And we noticed that he started to go down in personality. Wasn't our son anymore. It was anger, slurred speech.
It was surreal because the person I was talking to wasn't even my son. He was unsure of himself. He didn't have any will to do anything. At one point, he had stopped brushing his teeth, drinking water, eating, because he didn't care. He didn't even know that he was that way.
And I researched and discovered that our soldiers were being medicated and that they were committing suicide from it. So I printed all my research out and I handed it to my husband. And I said to my husband, tell me what you think of all this research. And he came back to me and said, if my calculations are correct, there's a pattern here that matches our son's behavior. And if my calculations are correct, he's just about ready to commit suicide. I was in the dollar store and he called me and said, I don't want to upset you, but I want you to know Michael's okay, but he tried to kill himself. And he put 2 IVs in his arms and he bled out in the bathtub. And he was drawing in his blood on the walls. He didn't even know he was committing suicide.
So his cognizance, his reason, was already usurped by these pills. They take away who you are. And he wasn't the same.
We had the hospital check him, and they found at least 9 drugs in his system. And they're just the ones they tested for.
They were giving my son drugs that had black box warnings. Said, if you're under 25 and you're taking this pill, your risk of suicide is going up 50%. Risk of suicide. But they were still giving the pills.
What he went through was so horrific, it's hard for him to talk about. But he allows us to speak because he wants to save his comrades. He wants to save others who are going through the same thing, who are being drugged with lethal cocktails.
Me speaking as Michael, knowing the things that he has said to others, he would say, stay away from the pills.
Psychiatrists claim their drugs save lives, but they rarely discuss the serious risk of suicide. Why don't they? Because those black box warnings for 18 to 24-year-olds, that's the age range of nearly half of all deployed American soldiers. And yet, the use of psychiatric drugs in the U.S. military has soared 76% since 2001. That includes antidepressants that psychiatrists hand out to soldiers to prevent suicide.
There is no evidence that drugging stops suicide. The reason I'm saying this is because it is alleged that somebody is suicidal, you should medicate them. Except there's no evidence that medicating somebody who is suicidal is going to prevent suicide. There's substantial evidence that many drugs actually promote suicide.
And last year, within DOD, there were 349 suicides among military personnel. That's
almost one a day, literally one a day.
That's more suicides than were killed in combat, and the military is very concerned.
In fact, in 2009, Fort Campbell, Kentucky was actually closed down by the base commander for a time because of they were having just an inordinate number of suicides.
The last I heard, the VA was getting close to 450 calls a day to their suicide hotline, which they set up years ago to handle the amount of veterans that have suicidal thoughts on a daily basis. 450 calls a day.
It's a problem that has echoed through the halls of government.
One of the biggest concerns I have about the military is the inordinate number of suicides that have taken place among active duty and those who've left the military.
3 years ago, I got Congress to hold hearings to examine the relationship between suicide and increased use of medications, and there was a direct parallel. The amount of suicides were increasing proportionate to the amount of medications being introduced.
So, do antidepressants cause suicide? Of course they do.
So, don't blame the soldiers. Don't blame the military as a whole. Blame the corruption of the military by the psychiatric industry that is peddling false, dangerous medicine, that is peddling a kind of modern-day quackery, calling it treatment, but delivering suicide.
And as bad as it is in active duty, veterans have it far worse. They're killing themselves at a rate of 22 a day, one every 65 minutes. But do psychiatrists ever consider stopping the drugging? No. Instead, it's an all-out assault.
I was a very highly functioning non-commissioned officer. I was a platoon sergeant at the time. I was kind of always being groomed for that next rank. I was getting sent to the right schools, had the support of my chain of command. Things were going really good. After I witnessed this traumatic event in my last deployment in Iraq, that's when the medications really started coming. I mean, full force. And like I said before, before I knew it, I was on 9 to 12 different kind of medications. And when I was going through the separation process in the Army, I had to get some physicals and evaluations from outside people. These professionals would see my records come up on the screen and the amount of medications that I was put on throughout my time in the Army, but especially the last couple of years, and they would literally gasp, and they were shocked at the amount of drugs, the high doses of these drugs. It was like a 6-page rap sheet.
With all the ways psychiatric drugs can react on your body, how do psychiatrists counteract a side effect from a drug they've given you? They don't take you off the drug. They'll either raise the dosage, which can cause more side effects, or they'll add another drug, which will add even more, then another and another.
It was clear right away that they really had no idea what anything that they were giving me was really going to do. They said, this drug may not work. You may need a different one. This one may need a higher dose. This one may need a lower dose.
There was friends of mine that I saw had 2, 3, 4 pills that they had to take daily.
You find soldiers that are on dozens of medications. And when I say, 7 to 9 drugs at one point, I'd say that was very average. I've heard as high as 14.
I know of some troops, personally, who were given up to 20 different drugs.
It's kind of depressing if you look at the number of medications that I've been on. It's very thick. It makes up a large portion of my medical file with the Veterans Administration.
And a lot of people were on not only psychiatric drugs, but drugs for their injuries. And the combination made them different. They weren't the same people.
They're mixing amphetamines with painkillers and antidepressants and sleeping pills. I mean, even to the unlearned, that sounds insane.
This practice is so common, they've even got a name for it, polypharmacy. And here's a little known fact. Many of these drugs have never been tested in combination, which makes those taking the drugs little more than guinea pigs.
The danger escalates with every increase in dose and every increase in the number of medications.
I have watched my clients who have been prescribed psychotropic drugs, sometimes a cocktail, often a cocktail, sometimes a single drug, and they are grievously changed.
If they were experiencing an adverse effect, how would they know which drug it was? Was it the antipsychotic? Who knows? Was it the antidepressant? Was it a combination? These guys don't know. All they know is they're supposed to take these because their doctor said they'll be better. And in fact, they only got worse.
And the problem is that there's no attention to the detail of what happens to these troops that are placed on them. There's no follow-up. They're simply placed on them, given a great big huge supply of them, and they're sent out to fight.
In fact, some American soldiers are routinely given up to 180 days worth of psychiatric drugs when they go to the front. No supervision, no restrictions. Just take them when they want.
What happens to it when they go into combat? Are they sharing with their friends? Sure they are. That's why I've been told by social workers, corpsmen, medics, that 90% of the troops in combat have at one time or other taken some type of psychiatric medication.
It's just a grand, crazy, insane pharmaceutical roulette that's being conducted at the expense of our nation's sons and daughters, really.
My husband never did drugs, nothing, never did anything. And I dated him 5 years before I married him, and he never did anything like that. And then when he was in Afghanistan, a psychiatrist over there started giving him the medications for depression and, of course, the pain that he was in because he had been hit. And the first time he got hit, they just started drugging him up. And the second time he was hit is when they sent him home to me. And 2 weeks after him being home, the violence was so incredible. I told him that we needed counseling or we just needed to get a divorce because I couldn't live in the abuse that I had just gone through because my husband never treated me that way. Needless to say, at that point, I didn't realize that these drugs were affecting him. At one point in time, my husband was on 21 drugs, 21 at one time. I mean, and it was craziness. This is not, I don't even know who this person is that I lived with. I've tried to get him help right from the beginning with the drugs, and they're refusing him any help. They just keep continuing to give him the drugs, and he's not getting any treatment. His physical needs are not being met, and he's continuing to deteriorate on a daily basis. The whites of his eyes are now yellow. They have a yellow tint to them. His skin color is green and gray, and this happens often. And we do have the fear that we will wake up in the morning and he's going to die. Every day we live that every day. His daughter lives that every day. I live that every day. Is today the day that he's going to die? Is today the day I'm going to get the call? They need to give me my husband's life back is what they need to do. They need to take him off the drugs so that he can think. He can't think. He doesn't know.
The horrible reality is that once on these drugs, it's hell to get off them. You can get addicted to some in as little as 2 weeks.
Now we have soldiers coming back from the battlefield, and they're addicted to psychotropic medications, and they have a detox reaction back in civilian life, and they begin to exhibit the side effects for which they were being premedicated. So they become depressed, they become suicidal.
Not only is it dangerous to be on these drugs, it's also very dangerous to come off of them. In fact, in many cases, the suicides happen immediately after someone stops taking an antidepressant drug. So if you do that, make sure you do it in a way where you have medical supervision and you have a support system in place so you can get off of those drugs safely.
Trying to get off psych meds by yourself, especially cold turkey, is very dangerous because of the terrible effects you may experience. Psychiatrists will tell you it's the return of your mental illness and that you need to get back on your drugs. That isn't true. This is withdrawal, just like with any street drug.
The doctor did not tell me if I did come straight off of these that there would be a worse effect. I didn't know that. So when I did come off it, I fell harder.
These are actually addictive drugs, and I didn't know how to act without them.
The withdrawal process is rough. And one of the things that I experienced is all these emotions, all these feelings, all these trauma, all this sadness that wasn't being dealt with, wasn't being cared for. It was just being medicated. When I got off all those drugs, it was like a floodgate.
Even though you come off those pills, there's a period of time for, I think, a long, long time that stuff is coming out of your system. Sometimes you think that life would be better if you were dead.
It's shocking how many soldiers are returning home addicted to psychiatric drugs. A U.S. Army investigation discovered that as many as 35% of warrior transition units have a prescription drug problem. And very often, the addiction is not temporary, but for a lifetime. But it can get even worse than that, because sometimes these drugs can turn deadly. striking quickly and without any warning.
Gunnery Sergeant Chris Bacchus survived the assault on Baghdad, a deployment to Afghanistan, and a second tour in Iraq.
What specifically killed your brother?
He died because he mixed narcotic drugs. Whenever he had an issue with them, they would increase either the dosage or the potency of the individual pill.
A bomb couldn't kill this Marine, but a bottle did.
Chris Bacchus had two antidepressants, two opiates, and the anti-anxiety drug Ativan in his system. A total of 27 different prescriptions were found at the scene, most of them recently prescribed. The autopsy said it was the drug interaction that killed him, something any doctor worth his salt could have predicted. The case of Chris Bacchus would turn out to be no different from hundreds of others. Only 450 miles away, Stan and Shirley White celebrated the safe return of their son, 23-year-old Marine Corporal Andrew White, from the combat zone. Little did they know what would happen when he went for help to a local veterans hospital, only to be diagnosed and then drugged.
Andrew's behavior really started to deteriorate. We saw more and more withdrawal. We saw anger issues. At one point, he slept for 2 or 3 days at a time.
The psychiatrist, their solution to his deteriorating condition was to increase his medications or to change the medications.
On February 12, 2008, Corporal White died in his sleep. Didn't even move, just died.
Coroner's report said it was an intoxication of these drugs. Did not mention that his heart stopped beating.
Andrew, being 23, being very healthy, not having any major issues, you shouldn't die in bed.
He was one of four veterans, only in their 20s, who were found dead in bed in West Virginia within just months of each other. It took a dogged investigation by a neurologist from San Diego to find out why.
I tried to understand how they could have died, what the mode, the mechanism of death could have been. And these dead in an undisturbed bed were cardiac. Suddenly the heart stops for some reason.
Tracking down every lead, he discovered that each had been diagnosed with PTSD. And all of them were taking the same potent cocktail of psychiatric drugs.
Came across literature on the antipsychotics, and they said that the antipsychotics have a particular danger. They can stop the heart suddenly. And here these veterans, all three, were on a combination of drugs which can cause or lead to sudden cardiac death. Might this not be the tip of an iceberg? Might there be others? And to make a long story short, that list grew to 250, 300, and today it is 351 probable cardiac deaths. The risk of sudden heart cardiac death makes those drugs truly unfit for human consumption. And yet they're being used like jelly beans in the military.
Another of those cardiac deaths was 21-year-old Corporal Chad Oehlenschläger.
Chad was hilarious. You know, super smart. Super, super smart.
He was a lot of fun. You know, he played sports. You know, all of that. Like any normal kid was, outdoors all the time.
He was willing to make friends and talk to everybody. So that's kind of, you know, what caught my eye in the beginning as well. So he was just fun to be around.
Well, he told me the reason why he wanted to join the military was that if he went, then maybe his children wouldn't have to go.
He really felt like it was his duty as a citizen to participate.
When he came back, we realized he was different. He had asked his commander that, you know, he wanted to seek counseling. He needed some help because he was having problems dealing with what he had done over there and what he saw on that first tour.
Just all kind of saw, like, okay, they're going to give you some medication. You're going to, you know, see a psychiatrist for a little bit, talk it out. Things will get better. We were so naive.
When he was on the drugs, he seemed like he was just doped up all the time. He was disoriented.
It literally turned him into a walking zombie. I mean, after he would take that, and, you know, and he was real adamant about making sure he took his medication on time.
It just felt like the medication made him forget what he was doing, made him forget things, something that had happened in the past. We'd be talking about stories and he wouldn't believe what I was telling him.
And he'd take Seroquel and then 10 minutes later be going back to his his pill bottle, said, well, I got to take my medication. And he's like, you just took it.
He wasn't in control, I felt like, in the end. He just really didn't know what he was doing. He wasn't going to work when he was supposed to. He said he would just sleep in his room.
I got the knock on the door at 11 o'clock at night. But when I heard the knock on the door, I knew what it was.
They had found Chad. And my thought was, okay, great, where is he? Where's little shit? You know, I hadn't heard from him. And he said that he was at the barracks. I said, okay, is something wrong? Can I go see him? And he said that they found him in his room, that he was dead on the floor. They didn't know how long he'd been there, that he was already gone. And I couldn't see him. I couldn't even get on base. All I could think of was that he was alone in that room by himself, that he was supposed to be safe.
It was harder for us because we always expected, if he's in the military, he's in the Marines, we kind of expected that if he were to die, he was going to die when he was out on deployment. You know, he was going to die, you know, killed in action, something. We didn't expect him to come home and die.
I had a doctor at Texas A&M University read an autopsy and then said that the levels of the meds in there were not excessive. They were in line with what was prescribed.
Nothing was out of range of dosage, but they looked at him and they said, how come he's taking, you know, 7 of them? It's a lot. And the doctor looked right at him and said they killed him.
I blame the psychiatrists and I blame the doctors for prescribing those pills. Those are the ones that never checked up on him and let him walk out with all the other pills. Didn't take any of the pills away, just kept giving him more pills. And they're the ones.
Psychiatrists call these deaths accidental overdoses. But let's face it, this borders on negligent homicide. And as our soldiers succumb, one by one, to prescribed levels of these lethal cocktails, you have to wonder if psychiatrists even care to find out why. It's bad enough that troops are dying, but this drug-taking ripples far beyond the victim. It can also affect the lives of those they love most.
I was with the 101st Airborne Division. I was assigned to them doing gun truck and convoy security, Operation Iraqi Freedom. I came out as a captain. I've got a total of 26 months in combat. When I came out, returned home from Operation Iraqi Freedom, anyone that marked that they had seen combat or had seen someone killed or had participated in combat operations directly, it was mandatory that you went to mental health. I myself was prescribed Prozac, Depakote, and at one time Zoloft. One night, I'll never forget this as long as I live. One night I had laid down and I'd taken my pills and I took a shot of Jack Daniels. At that time, I had my children staying with me. So I didn't get drunk or anything like that. Didn't drink overly heavy. And for some reason, I decided to sleep on the couch this time. And I can remember opening my eyes and not being able to move my arms and my legs and literally feeling like I was choking to death. And my son, who's was 13 at the time, he came in. Obviously, I was making some noises and he shook me so hard that I fell off of the couch. And that kind of woke me up. Literally, I felt like I was dying. And I can't help but think, if my son wasn't there to wake me up, would I have been a statistic?
Active duty or veteran, a soldier on drugs can negatively affect the rest of his family.
What we're seeing is that now this label of being broken and disordered is not only being utilized with our troops, but it's now also extended with their families.
You hear stories about these young children that are living with a deployed mommy or a daddy who just can't handle the deployments. So what happens is these troops that were deployed come home. Whether or not they saw combat doesn't matter. They're still being forced to take a subjective questionnaire, psychiatric questionnaire, and based off of the results, are getting told to do these drugs. And when they take the drugs, they become somebody that's different than what that child remembered them to be. Now that child has to deal with coping in a way that is very different than what they had to deal with when the parent was initially home. That child can't handle it. So what happens? Mom and dad says the child needs to go see somebody for help. Child goes seeks help. Child goes gets the same drugs that mommy and daddy's on.
Instead of dealing with the problem the right way, it's a lot easier to give a kid a pill, which ultimately destroys that young mind and ultimately erases somebody from society when that child commits suicide.
My youngest son, Daniel, was a very funny, a little prankster,
with lots of friends in the neighborhood. He was loved by his teachers at school.
We would go out fishing or hunting or just playing around out in the woods. So we're able to spend quite a bit of time together whenever I wasn't gone on training or deployment for the Army.
Daniel began having trouble sleeping very shortly after he left. And he was worried that his dad wouldn't come home. He was worried that his dad was going to get killed. And we saw the psychiatrist for 10 or 15 minutes. And he prescribed something to help him sleep and also Celexa.
Well, when she started telling me about the medications, I was very concerned. Overall, it seemed to me that, you know, the situation was continuing to progress and he was just getting worse.
My husband came home from Iraq 3 months early because of my concerns.
I was very concerned at the personality change to becoming much more drawn and sad and depressed.
He was having some bizarre behavior. He began cutting himself at school and he began having hallucinations.
Well, he never had any of those behaviors before being put on the drugs.
We were all here at the house. He was out of our sight for 10 or 15 minutes. And he had snuck in and went and he'd gone into his room. And I sent James to go find Daniel to help me in the yard. And he did.
911, what is your emergency?
We need an ambulance.
What's going on?
My little brother hung himself.
Okay. What's his name?
Daniel Raines. My mom is performing CPR right now.
Okay, let me transfer you, Joey.
He was an innocent little boy who was just worried about his dad, who prayed every night that his dad would be safe, and that his dad would come home, and that angels would protect him. But there wasn't anybody to protect my son. Psychiatry and the military took our youngest son from us and ruined our family.
Children are a huge target for psychiatrists. 1.9 million of them have a parent in the military, and a million have had a parent deploy. And when you're a little kid worried about mommy or daddy, that makes you fair game.
The numbers of children who have been put on drugs within the military TRICARE system is astounding. You know, it's just exploding. So it has an effect, a ripple effect on the entire family unit.
Now, today, we're finding out outpatient psychiatric treatment for children of deployed active duty service members has reached an all-time high at 2 million visits. How many drugs are these children being forced to take now?
Whatever it is, it's high. According to a study in the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, 91% of all kids visiting a child psychiatrist come away with a psychiatric drug. Is this really what we want for our children? You have to wonder why, with all this failure, psychiatrists keep hurting people, drugging them, addicting them, creating violence and suicide. It is for the most disgraceful of reasons. Psychiatrists say that disorders like PTSD can't be cured. Instead, they claim they need to be managed with drugs for the rest of your life. It's bad medicine, but great for the bank account.
Once you label somebody and you start medicating them, over the life of that person, it's going to cost the government about $1.5 million to provide these medications and treatment.
There's a lot of money to be made here. There's a lot of money to be made by the companies that are producing these drugs.
Profit is the only conceivable motive for all of these psychiatric drugs in the military.
Taxpayers are footing the bill for this travesty of medicine. These psychiatric drugs that promote suicides, you're paying for them.
So why do psychiatrists hand out drugs at such record levels? Because drugging people is a lot easier than actually helping them. And because of this explosion of psychiatric drugging, psychiatry has developed a very close relationship with drug companies, and they'll tell you all about it. Unfortunately, almost everywhere you look, you'll find financial conflicts of interest. Take Matthew Friedman, a psychiatrist and executive director of the VA's National Center for PTSD. Not only has Friedman been a paid speaker for 3 different drug makers, he also sat on the scientific advisory boards of the pharmaceutical companies that make Paxil and Zoloft. And guess what? These happen to be the only 2 psychiatric drugs approved by the U.S. government to treat PTSD. And then there's Dr. Elspeth Cameron Ritchie, until recently, the top psychiatrist in the U.S. Army. She praised the anti antipsychotic Seroquel for being very useful for the treatment of anxiety and combat-related nightmares. Not only is Seroquel totally unapproved for that purpose, it's linked to sudden cardiac death. Soldiers call it Serakill. On the street, baby heroin. That same year, Richie starred in a webcast, partially bankrolled by Seroquel's maker, in which she continued to push the use of psychiatric drugs on the battlefield.
Of course, I'm a psychiatrist, so I tend to think of psychiatric medications, and we treat soldiers with medications, with cognitive behavioral therapy, and other sophisticated treatments on the battlefield.
Finally, their psychiatrist and former Brigadier General Stephen Zanakis. When he was in the Army, he pushed hard for frequent psychiatric screening of soldiers. The more, the better. Today, the Army screens its soldiers as many as 5 separate times, including a mandatory psychiatric screening when returning home from deployment and a follow-up 6 months later. And these screenings are loaded with conflicts of interest. The development of one questionnaire, recommended by the Army Surgeon General, was funded by Pfizer, the maker of the antidepressant Zoloft. Another screening program for service members and their families is administered by a group given millions of dollars from 8 different drug companies. But Zanakis wants his own piece of the pie. He stands to make millions as CEO of a corporation selling a brain scanning device he plans to use to diagnose PTSD. Bottom line, with psychiatry, it's all about money, certainly not about help. And yet, without reforming this broken and ineffective system, the United States Department of Veterans Affairs recently hired 1,600 more mental health workers just to handle the problems the profession itself worsened.
If all we're doing when we get more mental health professionals is more of the same thing, but then it's a fool's errand.
And for the soldier who joined out of duty and served with honor, it all boils down to one word: betrayal.
One of the things I have the benefit of, really, is getting thousands of emails a week, whether it's from veterans or other people suffering from pharmaceutical damage. It's specifically veterans these days. We see an increase. We see people calling out and saying they feel betrayed.
They are very proud to serve, fight for their countries, protect, you know, the people back home, their loved ones. And I think all they ask for is to come home and be treated fairly, given answers, and looked after. And they're not looked after, they're told, it's all in your head, it's mental, take the tablets, it'll cure, go away, and that's it. And I think that is betrayal. For a word to use for those people is an understatement.
It's the deepest betrayal of a human being to kill them while claiming you're treating them. To call it medicine and deliver death.
And it's all so needless. Because there is hope, and it doesn't involve psychiatric treatment. Look around, and unfortunately, you'll find a world saturated with psychiatry. But there are safe, effective, and workable solutions, and they can be found.
The main word for soldiers, and not only soldiers, but anybody suffering from any type of mental, so-called mental illness, is that there's hope. That there's hope out there, there's solutions out there, things are available for you to get your life back, to not have suicidal thoughts, to not end your life, and it does not include psychiatric drugs.
There is a way to solve this. It's to get rid of the drugs and start treating soldiers like human beings, not lab rats. That's the solution.
The vets who get over their war wounds do it on their own, do it with friends, do it with colleagues, do it in support groups. They're doing it separate and distinct from the medical interventions.
If you talk to lads, when they get together, they help one another, they support one another. They are aware of fellow feeling, fellow understanding. Psychiatrists, by having the opportunity to disrupt that process by using drugs, can often disrupt rather than support it.
A soldier does need help. He needs care and love and friendship and, you know, whatever else is going to make him feel better personally, but he does not need psychotropic drugs.
True medical care can begin with a full, searching physical examination by a competent medical doctor to check for any underlying injury or illness that may be causing emotional distress.
Every symptom should be investigated for physical origins, because if you don't do that, almost certainly someone who has a real physical symptom is being labeled as having a psychiatric symptom, which is false.
By making sure that we clear up any physical issues, we begin to make the soldier, the veteran, feel better. Once they begin to feel better physically, they feel better emotionally, and they're able to deal with some of the issues relative to the traumas or the stress that they were under while in combat.
If you're on psychiatric drugs and want to get off, make sure it's under the supervision of a competent medical practitioner.
Getting off the drugs is one of the best things that I've done, and because it's helped me out. It helped me be back being Mike Mezen, you know, and it really saved my life.
It's transformed my life. But at the same time, it's also made me look real hard at the damage that those drugs were doing me while I was on.
It was that type of incident that catalyzed my resolve to aborting the system that I was in and moving forward with a non-pharmaceutical approach, which has been phenomenally successful for me. I'm not the same person.
But there are still many soldiers right now very much at risk for being ordered onto psychiatric drugs. That's why it's vitally important to know your rights.
There is an obligation for the service to take care of our sons and daughters that are sacrificing themselves and giving an oath to defend the Constitution with their life. I mean, that's a big deal. The command may say you have to go to see a psychiatrist because we believe you to be unstable. So does he have to show up for the appointment? The answer is yes. However, once you go into that therapist office, you are not required to participate in that treatment. So on occasion, I have people that call me and ask me, you know, can I refuse this or can I refuse that? And I say, absolutely.
Underlying this right to refuse is one of the most important rights of all, informed consent. Informed consent means you have the right to be informed in advance of all risks and benefits of the proposed psychiatric treatment, any alternative treatments, and the option of no treatment at all.
Do active duty and military have a right to informed consent? Absolutely. But these soldiers, sailors, Marines are not informed as to all of the consequences of these medications, because if you were truly informed as to the consequences of taking these drugs, would you really take them? You know, and the answer is most likely no.
Informed consent is just one of many rights you have under the Military Code of the United States. Numerous other countries also offer informed consent rights, but it is up to you to demand it. Get involved and tell others about these rights. Many courageous survivors of military psychiatry and their families are speaking out right now, and they could use your help.
I don't want another family to experience what we've experienced. Unfortunately, it's happening.
This is an outrage. What's going on here? Are these young people just guinea pigs? Apparently so. My daughter was a guinea pig, and she's gone.
One of Tony's last things, you know, he always told me, just keep speaking up, Mom. Even if you only help one person, just keep speaking up.
My goal is not just to tell Anthony's story, but I feel it's a story that's not unique. It's something that's happening to so many of our troops.
As an advocate for my son and an advocate for wounded veterans across the country, our group that I work with, we're trying to make a change in that direction.
So we've made it our mission that we're going to tell everybody we can, have the website, have as much information that we can.
We've got to get the word out to our soldiers. Don't take these drugs. Don't take these drugs. It's the beginning of the end.
Immediate action is needed, not just in the United States, but around the world. More British soldiers and veterans committed suicide in 2012 than were killed in battle. Same thing for the relatively small Australian military. Over the past decade, 20% of the deaths of German troops abroad are from suicide, and the Russian military has a suicide rate 65% higher than the rest of the entire country.
What is the solution? Get rid of psychiatry and mental health. Don't leave them in charge.
Mental health will not improve until psychiatrists are no longer in charge of them.
I truly believe that they are destroying our military.
The battlefield is safer than psychiatry. Do you understand that? Statistically, you are less likely to be shot by an enemy than to be killed by a pharmaceutical drug. That's the truth about psychiatry.
And yet, psychiatry's reach today goes well beyond the military. It is just as J.R. Reese planned. Psychiatric treatment tested out and advanced within the military, spilling out into every nook and cranny of civilian life. Psychiatry is currently an international $330 billion a year industry. It promised help. It delivers pain, damage, and death. The hidden enemy has now been revealed. What happens next is up to all of us. You've got the facts. Fight back.
Apparently, it's not something that a lot of people care about or even want to confront. And that's what these are. Do you know the most effective course of therapy? The most effective course of therapy. There's two of them. One of them is to sit down and talk to somebody who actually gives a damn. I mean, just sit down and talk to somebody. You don't need to have a therapist. I'm walking down the street in Sacramento, and there's this girl sitting on a bench, and she looks like her dog just got run over, and then somebody picked it up and ran down the street with it. And I sat down to her, and she was a beautiful girl. Anyone else would have said, let's try and hit on her. I sat down and said, what's wrong? And I listened to her talk for about an hour and a half. I don't even remember what she talked about, but she was sad. She needed a sounding board. She needed to tell somebody that actually gave a crap about her. And afterwards, she hugged me, and I went on my way. I didn't ask for her name. I didn't care. I was just there to help. That's one way. The other way is what I learned on a reservation. Now, we had a medicine man. One day, this guy comes to him, and the elder says to him, he says, come with me. I'm going to teach you something. So I go with him, and we walk down to the shore, the creek. And he tells the guy, he says, find a rock that will listen to you. Without a question, the guy starts rummaging around on all the rocks and walking along. And he finally comes back with this rock about the size of his hand. He says, good. Now, you and your rock go somewhere, and you sit, and you talk to it. And then that was it. About a week later, the guy comes back. You can see he's doing much better. He really is. Now, this isn't a joke. This is real. I'm there. I'm a kid. I'm watching this. So the guy comes back and he sits down and he's talking to the old man. And the old man says, well, how is your life doing now? And he says, well, it's doing much better. I'm happier. I'm calmer. I'm much, you know, and he just says everything's much better for him now. And then the guy looks up at the old man and he goes, it's one problem though. And the old man goes, what? And he said, that rock, it just has no sense of humor. You take your attention off of you is what it is. And one of them could be a communication with somebody else. The other could be sit down and look at a rock. That's all. It just calms you down. But this thing, this drugging, is not lightweight. There's a lot of you out there who are very busy defending the fact that you're on these drugs and that you couldn't go through life without them. And there's those of you out there who have just given up, or maybe not just given up, but given up and said, there's nothing I can do. I'm just going to have to keep taking them. But I want you to understand, every single person who is on any psychotropic drug will do one or the other of what I'm going to tell you now. They will either become suicidal or homicidal to one degree or another, always. Not sometimes. And I agree with the speaker about psychiatry is making a hell of a lot of money on this, but that's just a byproduct. That's not the purpose of this. These people have been around for a millennium, and these people aren't the psychiatrists. The psychiatrists are willing tools. They're like the demons from hell. They serve Lucifer. And they make a hell of a lot of money. But you know what? If you could cure people's problems, you'd make a hell of a lot of money too. So they have an option of curing them or not curing them. Well, why are they allowed to not cure them and instead create further degradation and problems? It's because that's the purpose of it. The purpose is not to make money. Yes, they're going to make money. But I can tell you what all of this is. It's a justification for gun control that's coming up. Because if you're under mental health care, you obviously can't own a gun. If you come to me bleeding, I'll stop the bleeding. I won't give you a pill so that you'll still bleed, but you won't care about it. That's what they want now. This drugging of society, it's not just the military. You wonder how come we have police now that without any hesitation will put a bullet in the back of somebody, an unarmed man's head, or pull a pregnant woman out through the window of her car, or crush a kitten at a house, or kick in the wrong door, and I can go on and on and on. If I didn't stop talking for 24 hours, I wouldn't even have touched the beginning of the psychotic episodes that law enforcement are doing in this country. These people that are doing it are the results of those that are in the military that survived the drugging. They have become perfect desensitized drones. And that's what this corporate government wants. They want thugs that will do what they want, when they want, without feelings. That's a psychopath. And these drugs create psychopaths. They either create suicidal, desensitized people or psychopathic, homicidal people. Yeah, I know this is difficult to hear. But this is why this government is gearing up for war against us. Number one, they're deathly afraid of all the veterans that have come back and those out there who have gotten off of these psychotropic drugs. The drugs will destroy you. They desensitize you. They destroy your emotions. They cause you to become a drone. And you'll do what you're told because you don't know any better and you don't feel any better and you don't care. I know the lure of these drugs. I've had pains so bad I couldn't move, and I've taken narcotics. The pain was still there, but I didn't care. But this is a massive conspiracy to destroy 100% the human being's both willingness and ability to stand on their own.
I'm up in North Idaho, and they're always hiring sheriffs, deputies, and law enforcement up here, and the majority of them are under 30 years old, have spent at least one tour in Iraq or Afghanistan, were put on psychotropic drugs just so that they could perform up there and not commit suicide. And they come back here, and they're hooked on these drugs, and they stay on the drugs. And when you talk to them, you get the feeling that if you said the wrong thing, the guy just as soon shoot you as write you a ticket. Well, that's not everywhere, thank God. All right, this is the end of this show. Now, I really hope that I did scare the hell out of you, and you listened, and you understood what I was talking about, this virus. Nothing I said about the coronavirus, this Wuhan novel, they call it novel, meaning new, coronavirus, was make-believe. It was all real, and it's not getting any better. It's just going to get worse, especially as long as the governments continue lying to everyone and pretending nothing's happening. Just do your own due diligence. Pay attention to what's happening around you. This is the Armchair Survivalist signing off. Keep your nose in the air and your ear to the ground. And hopefully, I'll see you next week.